Yesterday, I went through some quite of involved formalism to show you how one can, at least in principle, you know, quantize in a consistent and gauge invariant way by functional integration a gauge theory. So, and the final outcome of this was that if you start from an action which is for the gauge field of the form d4x minus 1 over 4g f mu mu a f mu mu a, and then, let me remind that one can add fermions, so let me add fermionic fields, so this is the matter field for the Dirac fermion, so this is the original action, where this is the contribution for the Dirac fermion, this is the covariant derivative. So it involves the coupling between the gauge field and the fermion, because d slash is gamma mu d mu minus or plus, I don't remember, a mu in some sense with a t with some matrix. So these are the Lorentz, the group indices, and these are the indices for the representation in which the fermions live, because the fermions carry both the standard Dirac indices and the group indices. So those are group indices. Those are the Lorentz indices, and this is also group indices. Okay, and f mu nu is also the contains a nonlinear term, because f mu nu, we have seen, is in fact d mu a nu minus d mu a mu minus, I think, I a nu a. Okay. We have seen that in order to quantize this by functional integration in a consistent way, we need to add to use the gauge fixing. And in order to make this gauge fixing, this amounts to add to this action what is called a gauge fixing term in the action, which will enforce a constraint on the gauge field. And we have seen that, for instance, one of the possible gauge fixes, one of the possible gauge, yes? Yes?
That should be a Dirac index on psi, on the right-hand side, downstairs. That's one of the Lorentz, alpha.
I'm sorry, Dirac, yes. Sorry. Dirac is one index of representation of the value. That's all.
Yeah. Oh, okay. There's something which is the there should be a delta function within the bracket in the derivative. In the definition of the covariant derivative, the I.
Oh.
Cij.
Yeah. Yes. So I'm.
No.
There is no. Where do you see
the T? It says the U.
Yeah, yeah, just the sum of other things.
Representation indices, I and J.
Oh, the delta I.
I and, yeah, so.
This was it. Yes. Yes. Okay, so you need to add a gauge fixing term, and in fact, the gauge fixing term, for instance, it may be. We gave two examples. One example that was that, so I will call this a gauge fixing term. And one example was minus 1 over theta squared d mu a mu squared, where zeta some, here zeta some parameter. Okay, We have seen that it is also possible to have another gauge fixing term, which is D4X, and by introducing some auxiliary field BA, and in that case we can make P mu A mu minus omega A, where omega A is some function. So those are two choices of gauge fixing parameters. Here, BA is an auxiliary field, which is just when you integrate over this auxiliary field, you get the gauge constraint that d mu A mu minus W is equal to zero. So omega A is some classical, I mean, it's not quantized, classical function. So it's one gauge parameter. Okay, so those are two possible choices. And we have seen that in order to compensate for this gauge fixing term and to treat properly the measure in the functional integral, you have to add a ghost, what is called rather the Fadeyev-Popov term involving ghost and anti-ghost, and which is simply in both cases, this is simply so the S for the Fadeyev-Popov is integral d4x, and then I have the C bar d mu of C acting on C, where d, so this d mu acts on d mu, is d mu a covariant derivative like that, but acting on the the ghost field. So we have those ghost fields C of X and C bar of X, which are the ghost and anti-ghost. They carry group indices, so they are in the same representation of the gauge group than the gauge potential. They carry no spin, and they anti-commute, so they correspond to a fermionic, which to quantum fields, which obey the Fermi statistics. So they are spin zero. Same charge as the AMU. So they carry the same kind of current than the gauge bosons, but they are fermions because they anti-commute, they correspond to anti-commute. So the commutation relation in a proper quantized theory, commutation relation of the operator will be anti-commutation relation. Okay? And once you have done that, in fact, what you have to do in order to quantize the theory is to define everything you will compute in the theory by a functional integral of the form. You have not only to integrate over A, you have to integrate not only on the fermions field, so that's the original matter field of your theory, but you have to make a functional integration over the ghosts, and in this case, possibly, you have to make a functional integration over the auxiliary field, if there is an auxiliary field. Okay? And once you have that, you have to compute your observable with an exponential I times the original action, let us call it S, plus the action for the gauge fix, the term corresponding to the gauge fixing term, plus the Fadeyev-Popov action. And computing functional integrals like that, you expect to obtain a sensible result. But of course, what you are interested by computing by your functional integral is to compute expectation value in the vacuum of some observable, some products of operator omega. So to those observables will correspond some function O of the fields. Okay? And you have to divide, so this will be given by such a kind of functional integral. And in fact, what makes sense in this calculation will be this calculation will give the result, which in fact is expected to depend on the gauge fixing choice. So, for instance, it should depend on, in general, it will depend on the gauge fixing parameters. For instance, here the gauge fixing parameter is this variable, is this number psi. Or in this procedure, it is this function, this shows a function omega A of x. Yes? Yeah. No, there is no b squared. Yeah.
I thought it was the least question that when you eliminate the d with the greatest immersion, you get back. Oh, but you're integrating over omega as well.
No, you. When you integrate over omega.
So that should get integrated over omega as well.
Yeah. But in this second choice, you can choose the omega. You can choose for omega to be equal to zero, and you get the lambda gauge. Omega equals zero means that du a mean is equal to zero. And then you have no omega at all. You simply have to integrate over BA. In fact, it's possible to integrate over BA because BA is coupled to A, and A is an A squared term. So, in fact, you have a matrix, you have to integrate over a quadratic form where you have a matrix when you are computing the A and the B part and the A and the B part. Here you have a zero because you have no square term, but here you have something which is non-zero, and here you have something which is non-zero. And that's a matrix you can invert. You can integrate over the B, although there are no B square term. So it's not a problem. Okay? But for instance, you see, for instance, that those two choices of gauge fixing, choice 1 and choice 2, are, for instance, equivalent, because if I choose omega A equals 0, or if I choose psi to be equal to 0, I get the same gauge, which is du and mu equals 0. In some cases, well, those two formulations of the
How
theory.
Do you choose psi equals 0?
Pardon?
How do you choose psi equals 0? You just send it to infinity and I kind of.
Pardon?
You just send psi to. One of the psi to infinity.
This one. This one. I can set it to zero in the calculation. Then I will get the 1 over infinity. But this means simply that in the gauge fixing condition, this exponential of 1 over psi d mu a mu, which is the motion, you know, you have something in d mu a mu. You have a motion with a width, psi. And it just becomes the delta function. Mm-hmm. It gives the delta function which fixes the constraint d mu a mu equals 0. Mm-hmm. But in fact, although it's not apparent on this formulation, if you do the calculation, you will discover at the end that setting the function omega a equals 0 in this choice of gauge fixing of letting psi go to 0 will give the same result. Okay? So, but that's very important. So, you see that, let us come back, that if I compute some observable of the theory, or some amplitudes of diffusion, they will depend on the gauge fixing parameter in general, and also, something important, they will involve unphysical states. And in general, you have two kinds of unphysical states, which are both the longitudinal excitation for the A mu and the ghost field. Because the ghost field, the states involving the ghost creation of ghost and anti-ghost operator cannot be physical because they correspond to fields, quantum fields, which do not satisfy the spin statistics. So we have problem with unitarity and the conservation of probability. Okay. Okay, but so before going there, let us discuss a little bit just what is the perturbation theory. We have seen last time that this term involves, in fact, the gauge fixing for makes that the propagator for gauge field, for the gauge field is something which is simply delta AB minus I over K squared, where K is the four momenta carried by the photon. And then you, if you make the calculation, and it's, you get an H mu nu, psi minus 1. H mu nu is the standard metric, it's a Minkowski metric. And then you have a K mu, K nu over K squared. Okay, and that's, but for this group indices, it's the same propagator than the propagator you would have obtained in the Maxwell field, so for the quantum electrodynamics. So it's the same thing as the propagator of the photon using this kind of gauge fixing. So the result here is not different, not different for instance, for a non-abelian gauge field like SU2, or for the U1 gauge theory, which is the Maxwell field. So it's the same, simply you have here the group structure means simply that the charge is conserved. Okay? We have seen that there is a propagator for the, so this is a propagator for the A field. The propagator for the fermions will be simply the Dirac propagator. So it will be delta IG times I over B slash minus M, which is a ghost, is a, well, I or minus I, I don't remember. This is simply the Dirac propagator. Okay. And we have seen that there are now interaction terms. So there are interaction terms which come from the so you have interaction terms between three gauge bosons. You have interaction term which is between four gauge bosons. Okay? So those interaction terms carry a lot of structure because there is structure in this sense, because this gauge boson depends both on mu, nu, b, u, nu, rho, c. And here you have a mu, a, nu, b, rho, c, sigma d. And what's important is that, in fact, is that somewhere here, you have a complicated problem, but basically this term is proportional to one of the momentum p, which so you have momenta carried by the photon, and it's each term in this vertex are proportional to one of the incoming momenta. Where here, these terms, so of course there is a g, there is a factor g which is a coupling constant. This was a g squared here, so it's a g. Sorry, this is g squared. And this vertex is proportional to g squared, but there are no dependence on the momenta. There are dependence on the group indices and the charge and the spin, but no, yes? So
the denominator of the Dirac propagator, is that a covariant derivative, or?
Oh, no, it's just the ordinary derivative. It's the ordinary derivative.
Okay.
So it will be a k slash minus m. It's just the ordinary derivative. Okay? So that's the interaction term for the derivative. You have the standard interaction term for the, which is up to mu a, and here I have an I alpha and a g beta. I have an interaction term between the gauge boson and the fermions, okay, which up to some group symmetry factor will be the same than the interaction term for the between the photon and the fermions in QED. Okay? And finally, we have the ghost. We have the propagator for the ghost, for the C bar, for C and C bar. We have a propagator for the ghost, where the propagator for the ghost, so the ghost I denote it by just a dashed line. The ghost carry some group indices, and the propagator for the ghost is just a delta AB, so the charge are conserved by a proposition by the ghost. And there is a factor minus I over K squared, which is the same, where K is the momentum carried by the set. So it's the propagator, in fact, of a massless scalar particle. And finally, we have a term of interaction between the ghost and the gauge boson, which carries a factor G. There is some group structure because there is an A, B, C here, and mu index here. So there is a group a term which contains the group's information about how the charges are exchanged during the interaction. So it will be, in fact, a structure constant of the algebra. And what's important, there is a factor G. And in fact, there will be a factor P, where P is the outcoming momenta. So remember, the important thing is that this vertex do not depend on the momenta. This vertex depends on the momenta in a linear way, and this vertex depends on the momenta. Okay? And now we can just keep in mind this picture to discuss what is the renormalization of the theory, because one of the most important question once this formalism had been built in the beginning of the 70s was to understand whether these gauge theories are or are not renormalizable. Okay? And for that, you have to consider where are the possible divergence of the theory. Okay, so means can we get rid of the ultraviolet divergences of the theory? So I won't discuss at all in detail how this divergence. I will give you just the idea of what to look at. Remember, we have to look at the. In fact, what's important is to look at the irreducible function, so which generates the effective action. So we have to look at the two-point function. The theory at the three-point functions and at the four-point functions of the theory, because in fact you see that you expect that here you have vertices which interaction between three particles or four particles. And well, now you can do diagrammatic, and you see, for instance, that if you are, I am considering the irreducible or the irreducible function involving two gauge field, well, you will have first the propagator that I wrote here, and then at second order, at order G squared, you will have in fact three kinds of diagrams, or four kinds. In fact, first you will have the standard diagrams, which is already present in electrodynamics, which is just a loop involving a fermion and an antifermion. So you have a gauge boson which propagates, and at some point it creates a pair of a fermion and its antifermions, and so it's a fluctuation in the vacuum, and then they annihilate and they form the photon. So that's the standard process, that's a fermionic loop. Now you have to remember that the gauge boson interacts with itself. So you can have also a process where a gauge boson creates a pair of gauge bosons, which creates a boson again. So this corresponds to a diagram like that. You also have a process like that, because you have a four boson interaction, and that's a diagram that we have met already when discussing the renormalization of phi 4. Okay, and finally, you have to, yes?
Is that a g squared term, or?
It's a g squared term, because this vertex comes with a g, this vertex comes with a g.
No, the last one.
This one is a g squared, yes?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Well, of course, this diagram is also proportional to g. Okay? And finally, you have to remember that you have also those bits of strange ghosts. So you may also have a process where a gauge boson creates a ghost and an anti-ghost, which run like so. Okay? And something very important is that both the fermion and the ghost are particles which obey the Fermi statistic, while the gauge bosons are bosons. They are spin 1 particles, so they obey the Bose-Einstein statistics. And in fact, this means that if you do the calculation taking into account the fact that psi and psi bar and C bar are anti-commutating variables, in fact there is a minus sign associated to a loop of fermions. That's something which you have met already in quantum electrodynamics. And there is also a minus sign in the ghosts. Okay, it's not very important because I have not written what are all the coefficients which come from the contraction of the indices, but in fact you have to remember that you have a minus sign here and the minus sign here, because if you have fermions, there is a minus one sign, a minus sign per loop of fermions. Okay? Okay, now let us look at this kind of diagram. So you see, here the propagator, we are now in 4 dimensions. Okay, as usual. So these loops carry an integral of the four momenta of the products of the propagator. Okay, times the products of the propagator. Here, for the fermions, remember, the fermions carry the propagator of a fermion behaves like 1 over k. The propagator for the fermions behaves like, of course, 1 over k. We have seen that because it's a 1 over k slash. So once you do that, you realize that you have an integral over d4k, 1 over k times 1 over k. So this propagator may contain a divergence which will be a lambda squared. A possible lambda squared. And then it may contain something which depends on the internal momentum p here times log lambda. Okay? This, here it is the same. Because you have seen that each vertex here contains a p. So either it's the p which is coming here, or it's the internal momentum k which is contained here. So if you realize that, you realize that these diagrams, in fact, may also give you a divergence like that. So you will have some number here with some contribution here. Okay. Here, the same things. You will have something like a lambda squared plus p squared log lambda with some divergence. These terms, in fact, will contain a possible Dangerous term, which will be a constant times a log lambda. And same thing for the ghost. the Gauss propagator behaves like 1 over k squared. But there is a momentum carried by the Gauss, so this can also contain the lambda squared plus a dangerous p squared long lambda. Okay? And now, if one does the calculation carefully, taking into account all the group indices, in fact, what comes out is that, in fact, because of gauge invariance, all the lambda squared disappear. Such terms disappear also because it cannot depend on something. There is a cancellation. And because, in fact, there are also log lambda terms here and log lambda terms here. And in the end, you end up with the fact that the sum of those diagrams diverge like p squared log lambda. So this finally, you have some coefficients times p squared log lambda. Where, of course, lambda is the ultraviolet regulator. Okay. So this means that, in fact, you will have to introduce in the fact there is a p squared log lambda where p is the momentum of the incoming gauge field means that you have to add a counter term which is proportional to a term like that. You see? Okay. So now let us go to now you have other two-point functions. You have two-point function for the fermions. Okay? And you have not to forget that you have also two-point function for the ghosts. Okay? And you find that for the fermions, you have a dangerous term which is in p proportional to p squared log lambda, where p is the momentum of the function. And you discover that for the ghost, if p is the momentum carried by the ghost, you have a divergence which is of the form p squared log lambda, once you do the calculation. Okay? So this suggests that, in fact, in the action, you will have to add a counter term. So to change the action by a term proportional to this one, this term, and this term, a term proportional to this term, and a term proportional to this psi, d slash psi. Yes?
Why you chose those terms to cancel these, therefore this kind of terms are necessary. The propagators.
Well, in fact, if you compute carefully this, if you take this into account, mu nu, there will be a tensor that will give p nu plus something, some coefficient, which will be delta mu nu or h mu nu and the other h mu nu p squared log lambda. And if you do the calculation in a consistent way, you discover that the coefficient of the p nu here and the coefficient of h mu nu here are just the one which can be absorbed into a term like that and a term like that. So because of the gauge, the more I think that because of the gauge symmetry of the action, of the gauge symmetry, there are a lot of cancellations. Those divergences lambda squared cancel. No lambda squared divergences. And there are some the symmetry are preserved. You find in the counter term the same symmetry that you had in the original action. And symmetries. Okay? So I don't show at all why this works and how it works, but I just tell you that, in fact, when you do this calculation, we already discover a lot of numbers which are the same. Yes?
So we saw before when we were talking about the OPE, the operator product expansion, that
yes.
These divergences come from trying to define products of operators at
yes.
So what are the operators here and what is the...
Well, for instance, here you have an operator. Here, for instance, well, let us consider this. Here I am considering an OPE of an operator which should be A, which will be an, on this diagram, I will be an operator when I have an AA and a BA. And I have an AA and a BA. And I'm trying to define the product of those two operators. You see, at coinciding points. And what you find is that this operator diverge like precisely dA minus dA. Well, at the end, the important thing is that they will diverge as an operator which will contain some dA and some dA. You see? Times. Times 1 over x minus y for. But of course, there's a lot of indices relative to the Lorentz structure and the group structure. And in general, this operator is not gauge invariant because it's just a part of a big something which is gauge invariant. And therefore, this you will have a combination which is not gauge invariant. And it's only when you sum. The operators which are present here, 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 and here, that you get at the end something which would be also still gauge invariant. Well, there are a lot of constellations coming from the gauge invariant.
Is it the gauge symmetry that makes all the miracles happen?
Yes, it's the gauge symmetry which makes everything happen. Okay? And of course, you have to work either in calculation very precisely, and that's for example done in the book by Michael Peskin, or in any good book of quantum field theory dealing with gauge theories, or there are mathematical proofs that it works. Okay. Okay. So but you see that you have divergences coming from those kind of diagrams. Okay. So now let us. So you discover that you have also divergence coming from the propagator of the photon. In fact, there is also a mass renormalization that I forgot to mention. There is also an M log de lambda, where M is the mass of the fermions. You have a renormalization in the propagator of the ghost. And then you have now, if you go into considering, for instance, a three-point function involving three bosons, then well, there are a lot of diagrams which intervene. You have diagrams involving the boson. You have diagrams. So you have a loop of fermions. Here you have a loop of fermions. You have a diagram involving a loop of ghosts. Okay. You have a diagram involving a loop of gauge bosons themselves. Those are ghosts. This has gauge fields, gauge bosons. And you have, in addition, also an additional vertex diagram, which is this one, which is also possible. Okay? And when you do that, you discover that, in fact, there are divergences associated to these diagrams, because, for instance, these diagrams diverge like a logarithm. These diagrams may diverge like a logarithm of lambda. These diagrams can diverge like lambda, so this diverge like log lambda. This diverge with a p, one of the external momenta that will be p. It can also diverge like a lambda because of that. So it can diverge like lambda or log lambda times one of the momenta. The same here. But at the end, everything cancels, and you find that it's only diverge like p times log lambda, where p is one of the momenta. And in fact, it has the same structure as the structure of the vertex here. Okay? Now, you may also consider a for loop diagrams involving four photons, so four gauge field. And then, well, it's an exercise. Let us show you can have a diagram with a loop of fermions. You can have a diagram with a loop of ghosts. Okay, then you can have a diagrams, and you can have several kinds of diagrams with loops of gauge field. And then you can you start to have many possible of them, because you can have a triangle diagram like that. Then you can have and then you can have something like that. Okay. And you find that those diagrams will diverge like a log of lambda. They will give you a log of lambda. Okay, and then you may, if you want to be consistent, you have to consider also how the diagrams involving a fermions field involving with a gauge field. And then you will find the standard diagrams which are present in quantum electrodynamics, this one. But you also have a diagram which is possible because the gauge field interacts with itself, which is this one. Okay? And finally, you can consider also what's happening when you have a ghost interacting with the gauge boson. So this is a ghost. And you will have the same kind of diagram. You can have a diagram like that, and a diagram like that. So you see that already at one loop, the combinatorics of the perturbative expansion of a non-abelian gauge field is much more complicated than that of quantum electrodynamics, and you have to check that these diagrams will diverge like also log lambda, and this diagram will diverge like if p is the outcoming momenta, like a p log lambda. Okay? And at the end, if you do the calculation properly, you discover that in fact, because of the gauge symmetry, and only because of the gauge symmetry, if you quantize and introduce an ultraviolet regulator in a proper way, you discover that in fact the theory is renormalizable. So the Young-Mills theory is renormalizable, which means that in fact, in order to make the theory ultraviolet finite at one loop, you have to introduce counter terms. And let me see, for instance, remember that the action for the gauge field was just something of the form. There was a d mu a nu minus d nu a mu squared. There was a term which was involving d mu some d. So I will write that in a very sketchy way. So this is d mu, but I will, okay. There is a term which is proportional to dA squared, so dA times dA with some indices which make that antisymmetric. You have a term which is proportional to dA dA A with a complete constant G, and then you have a term which is of form G squared A. Okay? And we have found here that, for instance, that there are divergences which proportional to those terms. So it means that you have, in order to make the theory renormalizable, you must add to this action counter terms counter terms, which makes the renormalized theory finite. Okay? And this means that I have to add to the original action S of A, I have to add to the original action S of a term which is proportional to G squared log lambda with some log lambda and some S1 of A. This is the counter term. This is the original action containing term of this form. And so it means that you have to, here I have to introduce a term, let us say, let us call it first counter term C1. Here I have to introduce a second counter term C2, and here I have to introduce a third counter term C3, okay, which contains some log of lambda in order to make, when you compute with this new action, which is a renormalized action, you get something finite. And a priori, those coefficients may be arbitrary, you see. But because of gauge invariance ensures you that, in fact, this can be recast in a given coefficient of trace of F mu nu A. So let us write it that way. F mu nu tilde F mu nu A tilde with, in fact, just, or in fact, let me write it in, state that in a different way. You discover that this coefficient, I have this coefficient C1, this coefficient C2 turns out to be C1 times some new coefficient that I will call Z. So C2 is not equal to C1, and this coefficient C3 is not equal to C1 or to C2, but it's equal to C1 times a coefficient Z, Z squared. Okay? It means that the new action is of this form. It's not exactly of the original form. No, it's something different. Here I have a C1, and here I have a C1 squared Z squared. Yeah, something like that. And this means that, in fact, you see, with those coefficients containing some logarithm. And this means that, in fact, you can, so in fact, it means that you have two coefficient independent out of the three one here. And this means that, in fact, you can rewrite this as C1. This means that you can rewrite this as, I am a bit confused here. You can rewrite this as, in fact, no, that's the opposite, in fact. Here, is there is a Z. You can rewrite C1 as, you can rewrite C1 as some Z squared, C2 as some new coefficient D times Z cube, and C3 as some new coefficient D squared times Z to the power 4. Yes, that's the way it is. Okay? You discovered by calculation that you have this. And so this means that, in fact, you can rewrite this as some z squared times z of, well, that's a bad notation, very bad. So I should rewrite this as rather as c1 as z squared. No, that's it. That's what. No, that's okay. That's z squared. No, that's okay. So I can rewrite this as d of za squared plus dg times d of za times za plus some coefficient which is dg squared za. Oh no, this is a dA here, zA to the power 4. So you see that the in addition to the fact that the logarithm, the log A disappear, you find that in fact, out of those three coefficients, you have only two coefficients independent, and this amounts to make first, a renormalization of the coupling constant. In fact, what happens is that you have to renormalize the coupling constant. And the gauge field MU. Because you see that, yes?
Deltas, the derivative should not be there.
Yes, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, there is only one derivative here, and there is one derivative here. And here you have. So, in fact, once you have done the calculation, you find that, in fact, there is a renormalization of the coupling constant and a renormalization of the gauge field, but it can be done in a way which is consistent with the gauge invariance of the theory. Yes?
So the point is actually called the normalization. You can see we actually are changing the normalization of A. You know, the coefficient in front of A.
Yes.
The field, the normalization of the field is changing.
Yes.
Is that why it's called renormalization?
It can change. You can define it as a change of normalization or of a normalization, but it's just the same thing. So you prefer
but to... So we didn't really see why it was called renormalization before, because what were we normalizing?
We are just... You are just adjusting the normalization of what you call a field operator. Remember, in any gauge theory, you have a field... In any theory, you have a field operator. For instance, in the scalar field theory we started, you have studied in Frenkel convolution. You have a field operator, and in general, so it depends on x, you can define its Fourier transform t hat of k, simply by taking the Fourier transform of this operator, and acting on the vacuum of the theory, this field operator, if k squared plus n squared is equal to zero, so if you are on my shell, this field operator is expected to create one particle state with definite momentum k. But so in general in the uninteracting theory, you normalize your field operator so that it creates one particle state with normalization one. Okay. But in general, if now you start to introduce interactions, there will be a factor z which is just a pure number. Okay. Z depending on the coupling constant. Okay, which is there because you start from a field operator in the uninteracting theory. Now you switch on the interaction, you make the calculation, take into account the interaction, and at the end you discover, you find the results, which is perfectly consistent with the fact that it's a field operator which creates a one particle state out of the vacuum. But simply, you have those calculations, there are no reason to change the normalization, so that the normalization stays one. Okay, but that's not a problem because this is just an operator of the theory, and there is just the important thing is that it creates a one particle state out of the vacuum. Then simply you have to change the normalization by defining a renormalized operator phi as the operator phi divided by the number z minus 1. So that's the number, so let us. Here, this is an operator, and I change the normalization, and say that this is the. Oh, it's original operator with some factor z, and with this change of normalization, we correspond to renormalize just the field operator. With this new field operator, it's well defined. So phi hat of renormalized of k applied on the vacuum creates a one particle state with a good normalization. So this is if you are to introduce a renormalization like that, which changes the definition of your field operator, it's simply because you have a field operator in the interacting theory that you have defined by making a perturbation of the field operator in the non-interacting theory, and simply you have to take into account that by switching on the interaction, in general, the normalization of the field operator changes, and you have to absorb that into the definition of a new field operator if you want to still have this normalization, which is the most convenient for the calculation.
Work with Weissman-Pohl theory. Why do we not see this when we work with Weissman-Pohl theory?
We haven't seen that in the 5-4 theory at one loop. Because in the 5-4 theory at one loop, you only have a diagram like that. And the diagram, the one diagram at that order, doesn't contain any divergence which is proportional to pi squared log lambda. And that's because there is no pi squared log lambda divergences in the two-point function at one loop. So it's one particularity just of the 5-4 theory. Okay? But if you go to two loop in the 5-4 theory, you get a diagram like that, which contains the pi squared log lambda divergences. And therefore, you have also to take into account the normalization of the field at two loop in the 5-4. But in QED, you have a diagram like that, which contains the pi slash log lambda divergence for the propagator of the fermion, the electron, in QED. Therefore, in QED, there is a field renormalization for the Dirac operator creating an electron or a positron out of the vacuum. Okay. So what I'm saying is that the fact that there are divergences like that tells you that you have also a field, you need also to renormalize, to change the normalization of the field operator creating a gauge field, or gluon, the quanta of the gauge field out of the vacuum in order to normalize it properly. Okay, so once you have done that, this means that there will be also a renormalization of the Dirac field. There will be also a renormalization of the Bose, which is the fermion. Remember, that's what I wrote here for the fermion. This is for the Bose. And everything boils down to the fact that the theory, the Young-Mills theory, is renormalizable. And that was one of the very, very important results of the beginning of the 1970s, because that was the starting point of modern quantum field theory application to high energy physics. So let me just give you, I have only 1/4 of an hour left, so I will be very, very sketchy, but so here I have explained to you the principle of a calculation without giving any detail. But what I want just to give you into some name, the fact that the Young-Mills theory is renormalizable at one loop was first, I think, established. So the fact that it's renormalizable at one loop, so at first order in perturbation theory, was first established by a Jung theoretician, well, at that time, Jung theoretician, Dutch theoretician called Gerhard Tofte. And he showed that, I think, while he was almost still a PhD student, in 71, and he performed the first calculation, the first reliable, let us say, calculation of the renormalization of the coupling constant. Okay. If you go into, if you read the review article that I gave you some reference a few lectures ago, he explains that in fact some Russian theoretician had already some hint of the fact that you can renormalize and compute the renormalization of the coupling constant a few years before, but their calculation was not completely consistent, and I think it went completely unnoticed at that time. Okay? And then, in fact, this but Toft, in fact, it's a funny story, because Toft really, you know, was a bit slow to publish his result. And, well, so there is an history a bit complicated. And it's only, in fact, in 73 that Politzer and Gross and Wilczek, so some American, well, theoretician from the United States, in fact, did the calculation, realized that it was very, very important for the theory of strong interaction. Okay. And why is this result really, really important? This result is really, really important for two reasons. First, the fact that non-abelian gauge theories are renormalizable, in fact, shows that they were really, you can really consider non-abelian gauge field in as you can treat them as a consistent gauge quantum theory. Up to that time, people were believing that they might be useful, but they were not really consistent, it was unclear, so they were not very popular. And the second reason is that, in fact, it is about the size, the properties of the beta function. Remember that we have defined what is called the beta function for abelian gauge, for the case of the phi 4, which tell me how the effective coupling constant G of the theory depends on the energy scale of the process. We have seen that in fact if you define, you choose some energy scale E naught that I call mu, and at this energy scale, you define what is the renormalized coupling constant by, for instance, looking at some diffusion process where all the momenta, all momenta are of order mu, okay? So this defines some quantity. So all the momenta of order mu. So this means that if I compute, for instance, some matrix diffusion amplitude, and if then I rescale, instead of considering momenta p of order mu, if now instead of that, I consider the same process, for instance, the collision process, at momenta, so this has a momenta, let us say P0. So I have a P01, P02, P03, P04. If I consider momenta at the scale P0, PI, which will not be the original PI 0, but the PI rescaled by a factor S, let us say, okay, by a scaling factor S. So I consider the same process at higher energy by a scaling factor S. Then if the theory is renormalizable, at higher energy, so at an energy E, which would be equal to the S times the initial energy E naught, in fact, the amplitude will be described by a process of the theory with an effective coupling constant S different from GR. because it has the effect of renormalization. And this, the dependence in the scaling factor, so S is the energy scaling factor, and the dependence of the scaling energy factor is contained in what is called the beta functions, because you discover that if you see how this effective complete constant vary with the scale of the energy, the calculation of renormalization that I show, which we made, for instance, for the 5-4 theory, but which can be made for the Young-Mills theory, shows you that, in fact, this is given by a beta function, which is a beta function only on G effective of S. Okay? And we have seen, for instance, that for 5-4, this beta function of G was of the form some constant positive G squared. So with some normalization, basically, the beta function can be taken to be of the form, this form, for G squared. So this is for 5-4. Now, the very important results of Young-Mills theory. Pardon? Oh, yes. This is simply G and beta. Okay? And the important result, the very, very important result of this series, and the result for first obtained by Toft, is that, in fact, for a Young-Mills theory, the same is true for QED. For QED, the beta function is, in fact, the coupling constant is alpha e squared, and the beta function of e squared is something like plus e squared squared. So it's the same. Now, for Young-Mills theory, and in fact, the result can be, for instance, written for an SUN gauge series, the beta function for an SUN gauge series is we have seen that it's the coupling constant is in fact G squared. So let us write it in this way. The beta function for the quantity G squared, which is in fact the real coupling constant of the theory, is of the form there is some coefficient, I won't write it, but there is a G squared term. There is some numerical coefficient which is positive that I won't write. And what's important is that there is n squared minus 1 divided by 2n with some normalization. And the important fact is that, in fact, this coefficient here is negative. So this is for an SUN gauge theory. So in particular, for the case we have been considering when n equals 2, this is, you see, there is a G4 here because the coupling constant is G squared. So in terms of this coupling constant G squared, the beta function is like that. Okay? And so it is the opposite sign than for QED or 5-4 theory. And in fact, yes?
Is this SUN-Mills coupled to matter? Or just
this is for pure SUN. This is for pure Young-Mills. If you couple it to matter, then you have an additional term. But I won't have time to discuss it. I have it in my notes. It's written in detail in the Pepsi book, for instance. This is the pure SUM. Okay. And this is very important, because this result, this was the first example discovered by Toft of a theory which is called asymptotically free. This property, the fact that the beta function is negative, is called asymptotic freedom in the ultraviolet regime. So, because what does it mean? So, you see that if the beta function is negative, it means that as you go to high energy, so S goes to infinity, G effective of S decreases. So this means that the effective coupling is small at high energy and is strong at low energy. And that's very different from what's happening, for instance, in quantum electrodynamics, where the effective charge of the electron is smaller at low energy. Usually one measures it at the energy which is of the order of the mass of the electron than at high energy. Okay? And this means that, for instance, now if you consider the constituent of matter involving an their interaction with the gauge field, the interactions becomes weak. So this means that G effective force, it means that the interactions are weaker. Interactions are weaker at high energy energies, and in some sense vanishes, if you want, they vanishes at infinitely large energies. Okay? And you can even have an estimate this, because you can integrate this equation. Let us integrate this equation d over ds of some coupling constant g, assume that is equal to minus g squared as a function of s. You integrate this equation and you discover that g of s is equal to g0 divided by 1 plus basically this will be a g0 log s, something like that. If at s equal 1, namely at e equal e0, g equal g0. You see? So you see that because of this minus sign, there is a plus sign here. So when you go to large S, this decreases logarithmically with the energy. So in fact, it tells you that the effective coupling decreases logarithmically with like 1 over the logarithm of the energy. See? Okay. And this, in fact, in the beginning of the 70s, was precisely what had been observed in a famous experiment at SLAC. And you have met last week James Bjorken, which was one of the pioneers of the theoretical interpretation of the results of those experiments. So there was those famous experiments where this so-called Bjorken scaling, so in the beginning of the 70s, was observed. And it was something very mysterious at that time, and it was explained by this gentleman. We say, haha, but this may be very well explained if the constituents which are inside the proton and the neutrons are made out of particles which are interact via non-abelian gauge field. And this was the beginning of the modern theory of all the quantum of the strong interaction, which involves quarks. So the modern interaction is based on an SU3 gauge field, and it involves fermions, which are called the quarks, plus gauge fields, which are called the gluons. Okay? And finally, if you give me 2 minutes, there is another important property here, or result of this equation, which is that now if you go into low energy. So if you start from, you have described your theory at a given energy E naught, you see, where the coupling constant is given by G naught, and you are asking what's happening at low energy. At low energies, you see that the effective coupling constant G of S increases. G of S increases as S decreases. And you see that even if you start from a theory where G naught is very small, which means that perturbation theory is reliable at high energies, you see that there is so G naught is very small at an energy scale E naught. You discover that when you look at energy at an energy scale E, there is a regime where G of S becomes of order 1. So this means that there is a strong coupling, and the interaction becomes strong at low energies. And you can estimate from such an equation where this happens. And this happens, of course, when, with this kind of calculation, when E over E naught is of the order of exponential minus 1 over G. Because this becomes of order 1, when this becomes of order 0, if you want, so that this becomes much larger.